The All Souls Forum is a production of the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. Each week, they present a public forum dealing with significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values of the contemporary world and that promote critical thinking. Due to an emergency, the scheduled speaker was unable to make his presentation concerning the Paris Climate Accord. In its stead, we offer a special Earth Day presentation from Peace Talks Radio.
This is a Peace Talks Radio special, Making Peace with Our Earth. I'm Peace Talks Radio producer and co-founder Paul Ingalls. Since 2002, our public radio series and podcast has been devoted to exploring what we call the art and science of peacemaking and conflict resolution strategies. We cast a wide net in gathering peacemaking topics and have several times included a look at conflicts related to climate change. We've considered how climate change might be touching off more conflict as migrants rush away from communities destroyed or threatened by rising violent weather events. We've aired debates over what to do to mitigate climate change trends and whether anything should be done, as some still maintain. We've noted how this opinion divide and reluctance to follow climate science has further polarized political discourse in the U.S. On our programs, we've heard from environmental activists sounding the alarm in different, sometimes creative ways, others taking the steps themselves to hopefully have an impact on reversing the troubling trends, even in the smallest amounts. We've heard from others still struggling with the anxiety over exactly what to do or feel. We'll be hearing highlights from each of these shows on today's program of unfortunately timeless conversations. We haven't made a lot of progress, it seems, in all the years since, 2007, when the Nobel Peace Prize Committee saw the climate crisis as a threat to world peace and awarded that year's Peace Prize jointly to former U.S. Vice President and environmental crusader Al Gore and Vajgla Pachauri, representing the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Peace can be defined as security and the secure access to resources that are essential for living. A disruption in such access could prove disruptive of peace. In this regard, climate change will have several implications, as numerous adverse impacts are expected for some populations in terms of access to clean water, access to sufficient food, stable health conditions, ecosystem resources, security of settlements. Indeed, there are many lessons in human history which provide adequate warning about the chaos and destruction that could take place if we remain guilty of myopic indifference to the progressive erosion and decline of nature's resources.
It is time to make peace with the planet. We must quickly mobilize our civilization with the urgency and resolve that has previously been seen only when nations mobilized for war. They were calls upon the courage, generosity, and strength of entire peoples, citizens of every class and condition, who were ready to stand against the threat once asked to do so. Now comes the threat of climate crisis, a threat that is real, rising, imminent, and universal. Once again, it is the 11th hour. The penalties for ignoring this challenge are immense and growing, and at some near point would be unsustainable and unrecoverable. For now, we still have the power to choose our fate. And the remaining question is only this: have we the will to act vigorously and in time, or will we remain imprisoned by a dangerous illusion? There is an African proverb that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We need to go far, quickly.
Former U.S. Vice President and climate crisis crusader Al Gore. We also heard from Vajgla Pachauri of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Excerpts from their Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speeches from December of 2007. Today on Peace Talks Radio, our host Carol Boss takes us into more conversation about this topic. First with Dan Smith, Secretary General of International ALERT, an independent peace-building organization that works in over 20 countries to promote lasting peace and security in communities affected by violent conflict. Dan Smith is the author of the report, A Climate of Conflict: The Links Between Climate Change, Peace, and War. Smith says understanding this link between the effects of climate change and world peace and security means understanding what he calls the consequences of consequences.
Global warming, which is caused by largely by carbon emissions, leads to changes in weather patterns. And those changes in weather patterns mean then that there are consequences like rising sea levels, melting glaciers, rainy seasons. Some places get longer, in some places there's less rainfall, the crop cycle gets shorter, and so on. And then as you follow through, all of those, the physical effects, have further consequences in the sense that they make the lives of people harder. For example, in Peru, the melting of the tropical glaciers is a really serious problem. Most of those glaciers will have melted by 2015. And while to begin with that means that there will be an overabundant supply of water, in relatively short time frame there's actually going to be shortages of water. And west of the Andes, which is where three quarters of the population of Peru lives, currently 98% of their fresh water supply is from the glaciers. So the overwhelming proportion of the water supply for the vast majority of the population of Peru is under threat from climate change. Now, what is going to be the consequences of that? Is it possible that, for example, water prices will rise? That left to itself, this result will produce water profiteering. How will ordinary people respond to water profiteering? We've actually seen from within Peru that they respond with protest and that sometimes those protests have turned violent. What will be the further effects of that? All the time we are tracing through the consequences of the consequences and trying to look at what are the risks which are being generated here. Because what we want to do is to say, well, how could it be possible to intervene? How could it be possible for the government of Peru, possibly backed by the Organization of American States, perhaps with the help of the Inter-American Development Bank or with the help of foreign donors, how could they intervene in order to reduce those risks and start breaking this chain of consequences and turn it in a different direction? And I think sometimes people sort of find it a bit difficult to get their heads round all of the imponderables in this. And the only thing which I can say in response to that is, well, we have to get our heads round all of these imponderables. The future is going to be different from the past. And if we're going to survive that future, and if we're going to even prosper in that future, we have to figure out the ways in which it could be different. And where those ways are negative and potentially even disastrous, then we've got to figure out a counter strategy.
There's so much discussion going on about all of this right now, and there are those who write about, those who speak about and believe that the link between climate change and conflict is tenuously made and has not been demonstrated. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I've seen some of these studies, and they're serious studies, but I think the thing to bear in mind with all of this is there are two things, right? One is those people who've been thinking about global warming and climate change over the past couple of decades have rightly taught us to understand that the future is going to be different from the past. So if you research past patterns of the relationship between environment or climate and conflict, and you don't find a clear relationship, you may be accurately researching what did happen from, let's say, 1960 to 1999, but this may not be telling you what is likely to happen from now and henceforth. And the second thing is that we are not talking about making hard and fast predictions. We're talking about risk, and we're talking about the management of risk. And if there is a case to be made, as we believe there is, that there is a serious risk of conflict as a result of the interaction between the consequences of climate change and other social reality, then surely something ought to be done about it. If there's a serious risk of an accident, shouldn't you do something to try to prevent that accident? Shouldn't you drive more safely? Shouldn't you walk on the pavement instead of in the middle of the highway? And so on and so forth. It's really no more complicated than that. And I don't think that arguments which show that there's no proof of a connection between climate change and conflict over the previous three decades or four decades are any kind of a guide whatsoever as to what the links could be and what we should do out of sensible caution over the next 2 to 3 decades.
And in your report, a phrase that I read over and over again is not only it's the notion of a different approach that you talk about being possible, but you say it's based on peace building and engaging communities.
Yeah. What we found as we went into it was that many of the activities that you would carry out in order to adapt successfully to the threat of climate change are the same as the kind of activities that you do in order to build peace. And this is because the key to it in both cases is the involvement of the community at the base. You've got to have government support for this. It's got to be led and inspired from the national level. Almost certainly, that needs international assistance for resourcing it and for providing encouragement. But if you don't have the energy at the community level, if you don't have the drive coming from there, from local leaders, from traditional leaders, and from elected leaders, this can't be done top down. On command. It can only be done bottom-up with the involvement of ordinary people.
Dan Smith is Secretary General of International Alert, an independent organization that's promoting peace in over 20 countries. In 2007, he authored the report A Climate of Conflict, The Links Between Climate Change, Peace, and War. Next, we visit with Thomas Homer Dixon, chair at the Trudeau Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto. He's devoted much of his academic career since the late 1980s, exploring the connection between environmental stress and violence in developing countries.
Within the work that we did during that decade, we were focusing in particular on renewable resources in poor countries. In those days, and it's still largely true, about half the world's population depends upon local supplies of fresh water, of cropland, of fuel wood, to provide for their daily survival. And we looked at places where those were under stress, where those resources were degraded or overused, where perhaps there were too many people for the resources that were available in those areas, and then tried to understand what kind of effects those scarcities of cropland, forests, and water had on people. You know, how did it affect their lives? Did it make them poorer? Did it cause them to move? Did it deepen divisions between ethnic groups in their communities? Did it weaken institutions? Weaken, say, local governments and even national governments? So we investigated all of those things really, really closely, with an eye on what the possibilities were for conflict, in particular insurgency and revolution and guerrilla war within these societies, how these stresses might contribute to those kinds of conflict. I spent quite a bit of time with my colleagues thinking through what might happen if the climate did start to change and what the implications would be, and it turns out that a lot of that original analysis we did now quite some time ago is really relevant. Because now we are seeing climate change affecting people all over the world, and we're seeing real impacts now affecting potentially hundreds of millions of people.
Why do some societies successfully adapt while others don't?
Well, that's really the $64,000 question, and it really relates to the issue of climate change. Are we going to have the capacity to respond creatively with innovation, with solutions to the climate change challenge that we're facing? I think of this in terms of what I call an ingenuity gap. In fact, I wrote a book titled The Ingenuity Gap. There are factors that are driving up our requirement for more complicated and sophisticated solutions to our problems. Problems are getting harder, and so we need better solutions, and we need a faster rate of delivery of solutions. And then there are things that actually, in some societies, stop the delivery of solutions. Actually prevent societies from responding. Even though problems are getting harder, those societies can't respond. And so in many of the cases we were looking at, we started to dig under the surface and look at the things that would keep people and governments and institutions from effectively solving their problems. Things like corruption, governments that don't have adequate finances are not going to be able to effectively solve their citizens' problems. And something that comes up over and over again is the power of special interests who want to maintain the status quo and block any useful reform.
Do you have, off the top of your head, some ideas about how people can wrap their heads around some of these issues and do something in their lives?
First of all, I think it's really important that people realize that climate change, in particular, which I think is probably ultimately the most threatening environmental challenge human beings will ever face, that climate change is not just a matter of the temperature getting warmer outside. It's going to affect every aspect of our economies and societies and the way we live, and especially the lives of our children and our grandchildren, because the biggest impacts are going to manifest themselves later in this century. And it will have effects on not just quality of life, but on life, period. It's going to affect whether societies can actually maintain themselves as stable, coherent, productive enterprises. So that's the first thing that I think people need to realize. The second thing is that climate change is a tractable problem. It's a problem we can solve. We have the technology, you know, like they used to say in the $6 Million Man. You know, we can do this. It's mostly about will. It's about mobilization. It's about political leadership. And it's about action at the individual and community level. 50% of the climate change problem is going to be solved by things that people do in their households and in their communities, individual changes that people make in how much energy they consume, what kind of technologies they use, what kind of lifestyles they lead. We don't have to sacrifice quality of life here, but we do have to change the way we live, probably fairly significantly. And we can still be very, very happy, though. And that's stuff that can start right now. You know, people deride Al Gore when he talks about changing light bulbs, but the first step is changing a light bulb. There's a lot more that needs to be done, and a lot of it's going to be a lot harder than changing a light bulb. But the first thing you need to do is think about the simple things and the easy things, and then you can go on to the harder. And it's not possible for everybody to do that. Some of it can be personal at the level of the household, some of it can be in terms of our own lifestyle practices, and some of it can be in the level of our political mobilization and lobbying for changes in government policies, and in particular giving courageous political leaders who want to do the right thing the cover that they need, the support they need to go ahead and do it. And that happens one conversation, one conference, one letter to the editor, one article to a community newspaper, one dinner discussion at a time.
Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon oversees the Peace and Conflict Studies Department at the University of Toronto. He spoke with our interviewer, Carol Boss. You can hear twice as much from each of our guests in that episode from our Peace Talks Radio series by heading to our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, and looking for our March 2008 episode called Does Climate Change Threaten Peace? This is a Peace Talks Radio special, Making Peace with Our Earth. I'm Paul Ingalls. When the British Petroleum Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in April of 2010 and set off the largest accidental marine oil spill in history, virtually everyone viewing the disruption to wildlife and the lives of the people in that region was devastated. We felt like it probably set off an inner conflict in many about humans' relationship with nature. So we sought out some voices of people who have already placed that relationship at the center of their lives to see how their experiences and thinking might help us all grapple with this conflict. A lot of the headlines during the 3 months when the oil gushed into the Gulf framed the event as an attack or war on nature. How can we think and act to make peace with nature? Today we speak with a social ecology professor, also a Native American environmental policy activist. But first we talk with John Francis, whose response to an oil spill in 1971 was to quit riding in motorized vehicles altogether for 22 years and walk all across the country, and during 17 of those years, not to speak a single word. In all that time, he completed the bachelor's, master's, and PhD degrees in land management. He's the author of Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time, and he talked with our Carol Boss.
It was only about 500,000 gallons from two tankers that collided near the Golden Gate Bridge. My girlfriend and I, we just rushed to the scene to see an oil spill. We've never seen one before. I've never seen one. And we didn't see it because of the fog, but what we did experience was the smell. And I wanted to do something, and I said to my girlfriend, I said, how about us getting out of our cars and just walking She kind of laughed at me.
You're talking about not just walking down the beach. You were talking about a larger decision?
Absolutely. I mean, I was talking about getting rid of our involvement with the motor transport altogether, meaning we walk to the store, we'd walk to the movies, wherever we had to go, we would walk.
That presented you with an opportunity to change, didn't it?
Well, it did, you know, and I think that these events happen in our lives all the time. There are all certain kinds of events that happen that give us an opportunity to make a difference in our own lives, and eventually what happens is when we make a difference in our own lives, we are making difference in each other's lives. But what happened was because in my community people saw me walking and they started to argue with me about how one person really can't make a difference. And I didn't know if that was true or not. I just found myself arguing all the time. Here I am walking around in this beautiful environment, and all I do is argue with my friends and my neighbors who often felt that what I was doing was something to make them look bad. And so on my birthday, I took the extraordinary step of deciding not to speak for one day. And that was what really changed my life most dramatically.
And what happened after that first day of not speaking? What did you notice?
Well, the first thing that I noticed about not speaking was that I hadn't been listening. And because I hadn't been listening, I had stopped learning. I would just listen long enough to believe that I understood or knew what the other person was going to say. And then I would stop listening to them. And I would start thinking about how I was going to say that they were wrong, or that, yes, they were right, but I could say that better, or I was smarter than they were, and this is what I had come up with. And that one day I realized that I had not been listening and that I had stopped learning. And I stopped speaking for another day and another day until finally I had decided that I was going to not speak for a year, and I would ask myself on my birthday if that was still appropriate because I was learning so much. And it allowed me to put myself, the things that I believed, aside to listen to someone more fully.
You took very large walks across the country. Would I be correct in saying that, in a sense, all of this was part of a recognition on your part of a personal responsibility?
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that?
Well, as I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge with my girlfriend in our four-wheel drive vehicle, I understood that part of what was washing up on the shore, I had some responsibility because here I am driving a motorized vehicle and we're using this oil, and I wanted the oil quickly, I wanted it cheaply, I wanted lots of it. And because of that, the industry, I was creating a demand, as we all do. The industry was responding to that demand. Now, absolutely, oil companies have a greater preponderance of the responsibility, especially when they spill it, but in all fairness, I have to take some of the responsibility myself.
Did that bring you a sense of peace in any way?
Not right away, because I think that when I made those decisions, I did make them with a kind of chip on my shoulder. And that's when I was arguing with my neighbors and my friends and colleagues about what it was I was doing and how it was going to make a difference. When I stopped talking, that allowed me to step back from that and to rediscover something, and that was the grounding of what I was doing and who I was, and that the walking actually went beyond a protest of oil spills, and the silence went beyond a protest of oil spills, but this was something even bigger than that that was going to allow me to rediscover who I was and who I had to be in the world or the planet.
For the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, which was in 1990, you arrived on the East Coast, and it was there, wasn't it, that you decided to speak?
I had walked across the United States, studied oil spills all the way up to a PhD level. Environment was my degree. And when I got to the East Coast, I finally had something that I needed to say. Environment, to me, had changed. When I started out, it was just about pollution and soon became about loss of species and loss of habitat, all those things we traditionally think of environment. But what I understood was, and it was in the literature, is that people are part of the environment. And if people were indeed part of the environment, then our first opportunity to treat the environment in a sustainable way, or even to understand what sustainability is in the relationship with ourselves and with each other. If we related to each other with respect and love and dignity and not looking to, I guess, exploit one another, to oppress each other, if we really treated each other the way we wanted to see our physical environment treated, then we would find that what would happen in our physical environment would be a mitigation of a lot of the problems and a lot of the issues that we are facing today. For example, and this is a very simple example, if I were a manufacturer and I lived on a river and I was making widgets, of course, and widgets were wonderful, everybody wanted them, but in making widgets, there's a waste product which I was dumping into the river. In economic terms, that's called an externality because I don't have to pay for getting rid of that waste product. As it goes downstream, my company learns that it's actually causing health problems to the town downstream and that they actually have to pay to clean up the river in order to keep from having these health problems. Now, if I were thinking like, hey, you know, how we treat each other is how we treat the environment, right away I would say, oh my God, let's stop. We have to stop and figure out how we're going to take care of this. If I weren't, I might say, well, listen, I want us to bury that memo, and we're not going to do nothing until people absolutely make us do something. And in that way, you can see how our relationship, our personal relationship with ourselves and with each other and understanding our connectedness would actually make a difference in the environment.
I know that it's easy for people to turn the TV off or to put a newspaper aside and create some distance between themselves and a tragedy such as the Gulf oil spill. How does a person know when it's their moment to make a decision?
Well, when the tears are running down your face, when you've heard something on the news, or when you have read it in the paper, you know that there's an opportunity for you to make a change, to do something. Because right then, you have passion to do it. Maybe the tears will go away. They will go away. But at that moment, you know that there's something that's touching you on an emotional level, and you can do something.
John Francis, who gave up motor transport from 1972 to 1994 and remained silent during most of those years in response to a West Coast oil spill. In 1991, he was named a United Nations Environmental Program Goodwill Ambassador. And he's written the book Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time. I'm Paul Ingalls, and today on Peace Talks Radio, we're asking for thoughts on humans and the environment in the wake of 2010's Gulf oil disaster. Kathy Juanpovi Sanchez is a potter, producing the highly sought-after blackware from San Ildefonso Pueblo in New Mexico, carrying on the tradition of her ancestors. She's also a community activist working on nuclear, water, domestic and sexual violence issues as a member of Tewa Women United. Carol Boss asked her for the Native American perspective on resource extraction, drilling, mining, and the like.
The perspective is that it should not happen. It is drilling and in water or on land is about an extraction, taking part in a process of the death and dying. And we're not allowing the materials to go through their process of the whole years and that it takes to be in Mother Earth and in their grave and in being able to be of use again within a million years. Extraction is violence if you're reaching into Mother Earth without the permission, without the sacredness that it takes to allow our natural world to be not harmed by our actions.
Did your organization, Tewa Women United, respond specifically to the Gulf oil disaster?
I think we responded by doing a lot more water ceremonies because water spirits are connected multiversally. And I said, you're water people. You carry that water in you. Just go to the nearest water. Give love and thanks to the spring, to the lakes, to the water you drink before you wash your face. Give love and thanks. And when you do that, that energy of that love, that water feels, they're going to feel that down there as well.
Kathy Sanchez, how do Native Americans who are conscious of caring for the earth act in their everyday life that connects them with this relationship with nature, such as shopping and using vehicles and building your homes?
I think as conditioned humans into this culture of violence, and if we want to be about the culture of peace, we need to do it within our means. We need to think about what we are capable of doing, whether they're baby steps, big leaps of change, what we are able to do, we should do. And it starts with prayer. Everybody can say their good thoughts. Everybody can always be conscious of offering a thank you, a smile. You have to be about purposeful living. And then you define that for yourself. What is purposeful living? Yes, maybe we have to shop, but where do we shop? Yes, maybe we're shopping 90% of our time. Let's cut it down to 60%. Let's make our own things. Let's barter. Let's exchange. Let's give without having to expect money. And how do you cut down? How do you start being more in walking on Mother Earth as opposed to zipping in a car going fast? Because then time is an element that has been taken from us. Let's claim our time to be with each other back again.
Is there a way to ask for permission and use Earth's resources appropriately?
Yes, there is. When we do our pottery, when we make our pottery, we have to get the clay. And so we offer our prayers and ask for permission to take. And we only take that which will sustain us. Mother Nature will heal itself. It's time that we really acknowledge who we are and how people are connected to Mother Earth, how we are landed people. We are land-based people. We are community people. We're not put on this Mother Earth as individuals. We're in a society, we're in a family, we're in a relationship. And even if a human were alone in an island, there's still the animals, there's still the trees that take care of us, that give us shelter, that give us food. We really need to think about relational presence.
Kathy Sanchez from New Mexico's Tewa Women United. 2 days after the Deepwater Horizon rig blew in April of 2010, long before the extent of the oil spill's damage would be truly known, University of New Mexico environmental sociology professor Daniel Schwartz delivered a talk he called Perfect Storms and Paradigm Shifts to a standing room only crowd in the Student Union building on campus. Carol Boss talked with him several months later when the well had finally been capped in the Gulf.
Imperfect human beings only make imperfect technologies, and therefore these accidents are quite normal. They happen on a regular basis. I expect these kinds of accidents to happen because given enough wells, there are 4,000 alone in the Gulf of Mexico, they're expected to blow.
Let me ask you this. Your response, how did you feel? What were your reactions at the time?
My reactions are always very sad because I understand the depth of this tragedy from a biological and an ecological point of view. The entire Gulf has been a natural disaster area and a natural national sacrifice area for a long time. The military has dumped shells and military hardware after World War II. There's very little environmentalism among the southern states. It's one of the most conservative areas of the country, and oil has a lot of control. And the tragedy is still not fully understood.
Daniel, you're teaching juniors and seniors. If you can get to the essence of what you would like to instill in these future guardians of our dear Mother Earth.
One of the things I try to get across is the Earth is alive. It's has a very powerful force for life. And no matter what happens to the Earth, life seems to continue on Earth. We've had some very terrible things happen that have nothing to do with humans. 65 million years ago, at least half the species disappeared. But life continues. I want to get that across. That Earth is still a very beautiful place. There's beauty wherever one looks. And I tell them to remind me of that sometimes when I talk about the seriousness of these issues, that we have to start thinking and always put Earth in our hearts and sort of making peace with nature, because right now we're at war with nature. And I think that's another piece to it, this idea that nature's here simply to be used by humanity in whatever means necessary. I think these kinds of things are extremely important. The life support system of this planet is diminishing, and we need to make a turn. We need to change the paradigm or paradigms. I present different paradigms. One of the new paradigms is called the precautionary principle, where we don't look at how much harm should be allowable, but how little harm is possible. The city of San Francisco has taken up the precautionary principle. A number of European countries have taken up the precautionary principle. You don't just go ahead and put out some chemical into the environment or do some process and then wait to see what the effects are. It's simply too dangerous. And that's one of the problems of drilling down 30, 35,000 feet after you've gone down a mile into the ocean to look for oil. And also what that does is marginalize alternative energy sources. So the new paradigms are important. How can we achieve prosperity with fairness and equality while minimizing harm to people, other living beings, and the environment? That would be a new paradigm.
Daniel Schwartz, are there other paradigms you have to offer that give people concrete options?
Let me relate a personal story very quickly. When I was 15 years old, I lived along one of the old transport canals near the Delaware River, which separates New Jersey and Pennsylvania. That transport canal we used for swimming, and boating, and fishing, and just hanging out. It was beautiful. It was a wonderful ecosystem with lightning bugs and so on. That transport canal will always be in my heart. The transport canal, in the name of progress, was transformed into a freeway. It was cemented over with little or no resistance. It was thought of as progress, and people did not act in their own interest, and they traded in this beautiful, wonderful canal and that whole ecosystem for a noisy, rather odoriferous freeway system with constant noise and constant odors, and gave it up in the name of an ideology instead of thinking, what's in our interest? And I think that happens often with the notion of progress. We don't look at the larger picture. We become rational or rationalized without looking at reason and history and the kinds of things that make life worth living. So the canal no longer exists. And I think that kind of thing happens in different places and different times. We need to rethink notions of progress. Progress for whom?
Daniel, are you ever challenged by students or others about the whole notion of, you know, we can't go back to a pre-industrial society? These are all advances, and this is part of what a modern society is all about.
It's a very good question. No, of course we're not going to go back to being hunters and gatherers. But hunters and gatherers lived in balance with their environment. Right now we have an anthropocentric system, that where humans are in the center of things. We need to move, I think, to an ecocentric system where we can learn to live a little more lightly. We can do more recycling. We need to think about consumption. And it's very, very difficult when you have advertising, when you have new technologies constantly being invented. New technologies tend to be very anti-democratic. No one asks us if we want these things. We don't vote on them. It's interesting. We think of progress mainly now as technological progress. So a lot of our technologies, new technologies, are used in war. Why would we want to go in that direction? why would we want to spend all that money to do these kinds of things that don't necessarily, and of course do not, enhance, in my estimation, the human condition whatsoever? I think that's the new paradigm, and we can't go on at business and politics as usual because we're in a new age. And it's only hyper-individualism and this idea that we can isolate ourselves and quarantine ourselves from the natural world that gets us into trouble, that somehow things outside can go very wrong in the natural world, but we can hide out, and we can't hide out anymore.
Daniel Schwartz teaches at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He holds a bachelor's degree in anthropology and advanced degrees in sociology, social behavior, and medical anthropology. I'm Paul Ingalls, co-founder and producer of our long-running radio series and podcast called Peace Talks Radio. We're online at peacetalksradio.com. As we've shown a light on peacemaking efforts throughout history and today, on both an international scale and in our daily lives, we've often addressed the conflict and consequences that humans have wrought on the environment. We've assessed the scope of the problem and talked with people who have ideas about what to do about it. And you're getting to hear some of the highlights of that coverage today. In our next segment, a 2020 program we produced in a year of record-breaking wildfires and storms that science suggests is a result of human-induced climate change. The collective feeling of despair these events have brought has been labeled by some eco-anxiety or climate grief. Our correspondent Sarah Holtz got perspectives on climate anxiety from a scholar and an artist. We begin the segment with Francis Roberts Gregory, an environmental sociologist who investigates the intersections between sustainability and social justice. Through a black feminist lens, Francis focuses on frontline communities which are disproportionately impacted by climate change, and she's working to increase their representation in STEM education. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Here's Sarah Holtz.
What are some of the best ways to combat misinformation about climate change?
I think there's a lot of approaches. So from a climate communications perspective, for change, you need dialogue. Oftentimes, scientists or even well-meaning advocates and activists, we come in saying, I'm right, you're wrong, listen to me. And the conversation is very unidirectional. But we need multidirectional dialogue, which means that you really do have to like share, listen. I would also say psychology is really important. To admit that climate change exists means that there's limits to growth. That challenges a lot of traditional economic theories that people hold. It challenges this idea that America is a place where everyone has opportunity and you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And it challenges people who are taught to think in linear ways and to think in hierarchies. So really, to combat this misinformation, it really begins with stories, having an open heart dialogue, and also having some empathy, I would say, because to attack people's deeply held beliefs, it's almost religious beliefs at this point, it's very disconcerting, and people don't do well with uncertainty. You see the panic with the crisis around COVID-19. We don't teach people how to manage uncertainty and change. I think a lot of frontline communities, communities of color, are used to dealing with uncertainty because we're always existing in a state of crisis. But for other folk, it challenges everything. So I think we have to like figure out ways to allow people to grieve, deal with that anxiety so that they can, you know, admit that there is a problem and then be encouraged to participate in actions to deal with the problem. I know for a while, we really just need to work with people who are willing to listen and, you know, plant seeds, because you might plant a seed in a denier today. It might not sprout for like 10 or 20 years, but I promise you, once we keep having disasters like the fires, the floods, the droughts, the food shortages, there's people who are publicly deniers, but in the privacy of their homes, they understand what's going on because they're being impacted.
In thinking about all the ways that climate anxiety is manifesting, both for folks who are maybe in denial and those who are in frontline communities, what are some examples of climate resilience that you've seen?
So for me, when I think of resilience, I think of people who dare to dream, to smile, to laugh, to dance, to build, despite like hundreds of years of violence. all of the frontline communities, the communities that have just struggled so much, where that trauma is like almost like embedded in our DNA, how like figured out ways to make lemonade, you know, take lemons and make lemonade, you know, to invoke all my grandmas and Beyonce. That is for me, the audacity to get up every morning for me is resilience. I should also say that resilience is a controversial word because people are tired of having to be resilient. Why do we keep having to fight? Why? Like, it's tiring. And I guess for a more climate focused conversation, I think that the women who are engaged in green infrastructure inspire me. They're saying, hey, we're tired of the street flooding, so we're going to have rain gardens and rain barrels. That inspires me. I think about the folk who are engaging in sustainable, organic, regenerative farming, who are bringing back heirloom varieties, who are figuring out ways to grow using aquaponics and agroecology. I think about also the folk who are living in ceremony, who are practicing gratitude, figuring out ways to, in the words of Adrienne Marie Brown, promote pleasure activism, to find joy within toxic landscapes and despite ongoing chronic violence. We all have a role to play. And I definitely say I want to increase the representation of underrepresented folk in climate policy spaces, because these spaces are still mostly white and male, and that's not appropriate. And also, there's so much creative potential in frontline communities, indigenous communities, women of color, women in general. So I really want to increase our representation in these decision-making spaces. And I want to share these stories. Like, that's my role as a griot. That's my role as a feminist anthropologist, as a Black geographer, to share these stories, hope that they inspire a call to action. As an Afrofuturist, I really hope that our futures are based in healing. The idea of resilience is to return to the past and the status quo. And I don't want to return to the status quo. I want something better. I want something great.
I also know that you identify as an eco-womanist. What's an eco-womanist?
So an eco-womanist, as defined by Dr. Melanie Harris, is a feminist environmentalist, a woman of color who connects the personal to the political and political to the personal. And really, this is based off of the work of the great Alice Walker. She coined the term womanism, which is women of color's version of feminism, because many women of color had an issue with how white middle-class women had co-opted the feminist movement. So they said, we need our own term that relates to our own experiences. But a womanist is a feminist of color. So an eco-womanist is a feminist of color who is believes that women of color have unique solutions for environmental degradation and addressing the climate crisis. Also who are really connected to ancestors and future generations and understanding what a woman of color environmental ethic looks like.
Yeah, and you've also written about the importance of a feminist lens on the global Green New Deal. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. So although we can debate for days about the wording of Green New Deal, is that appropriate? Like, there's baggage that comes along with that language. We do need policies that make sure that there is a earth for future generations, and that we are thinking about equity when we talk about renewables and living more sustainably, when we talk about green infrastructure. And we also have to bring in intersectional perspectives, because when we don't center frontline communities, indigenous communities, when we don't center women, when we don't center human rights, youth, we actually exacerbate the problem. Most people don't realize that climate change does not impact us all equally. Climate change actually exacerbates existing gendered and racialized inequalities. And so using an intersectional perspective, we can talk about how after many disasters, there's a rise in gendered violence, domestic violence, and also sex trafficking, violence against indigenous women. We can talk about how women make up the bulk of the membership of grassroots organizations, how women are water protectors, how reproductive justice is connected to climate change, and how when we have extreme weather and disasters, there's a rise in preterm births, women who deal with children with low birth weights, even like how it impacts LGBTQ communities and their inability to maybe access resources and hormones, or how they might not have access to certain shelters, or they're put in shelters that are inappropriate that exposes them to increased violence. I would just finally add that it's important to understand that when we talk about gender and climate change, although I focus on women and women of color, gender is not synonymous with women. Gender is everyone. Everyone, gender impacts everyone. Everyone has a gender, you know, gendered norm. So we're talking about impacts on men, on women, on non-binary folk, LGBTQ communities. And there's a need for greater research. But once again, we're having to take baby steps so that people first understand that there is a climate crisis, that it doesn't impact everyone equally, and that the people who contribute the least to greenhouse gas emissions are usually the ones most impacted by disaster.
You can hear more of Sarah Holtz's interview with environmental sociologist Francis Roberts Gregory at our website. Visit peacetalksradio.com and look for our April 2020 episode. I'm Paul Ingalls with Sarah Holtz as today we explore how we're handling the anxiety around climate change. And now Monique Verdin, an artist and storyteller in South Louisiana. Her work illuminates the experience of her community, the Mississippi River Delta's indigenous Houma Nation. Here Monique describes her debut documentary film.
My Louisiana Love is about an hour long documentary, and through this kind of personal lens of just documenting my life and my family, stories of my grandmother and her being raised in, you know, what is now disappearing or disappeared land in some cases. There were prairies, there were pecan groves, there was a healthy ridge. And to recognize that in one's lifetime, how quickly things have changed here and how that loss of land and connection to the water. I kind of think of it as putting a parenthesis around the last 100 years in South Louisiana, but from an indigenous perspective, from a hyper personal perspective, which was not the original intention when I started collecting footage in the late 90s. So, you know, I think for me in making my Louisiana Love, it has also been me trying to understand what's happening here.
You know, you mentioned that one of the proposed solutions from the state is this engineering intervention that sort of supposes that, okay, maybe it's too late. Do you work within that framework, or are there ways to solve the problem? Or at this point, since a lot of your work is so personal and focused on place and family and home, is it about preservation or all of the above, I guess?
Yeah. Recently, my new mantra is remain and reclaim. I think that lift or leave doesn't feel right. Retreat and return, that's a big maybe, yeah. But I also wonder often if I'm kidding myself, you know, like, did I drink the Kool-Aid too and think that, like, I can build a house on a concrete slab on top of land that is essentially like pudding land, and there be a big levee wall around me that, you know, the federal government spent like $1 billion to build and is sinking, and, you know, but I can get flood insurance, like, you know, okay, I'll get a mortgage on that, like, first time homeowner, what, you know, there are times where I'm talking like out of both sides of my mouth saying, yeah, you know, home is home. There's no place like home. Plant your fruit trees and like keep your seeds growing. And then there's another part of me that's like, you know what? I live right down the street from two major oil refineries, and I've packed my car too many times to evacuate, to be naive and think that I won't have to do that again. And I also know I don't really know where to run to. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it makes sense though, that what you said, you know, kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, because a situation as complex and, you know, rife with systemic inequality, it's going to force people to have to operate in like both mindsets at all times.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I really think about what I need most, it is my community. I think that, you know, when everyone was scattered to the wind after Katrina and then that ability to come home, but also that people have to leave home all the time, all over the world for many different reasons. And that as time goes on, that I think the great migration from the coast has already begun and it will continue. You know, I feel like Chicken Little a lot, like, the land is sinking, the oil is coming, the, you know, whatever. Like, yeah, we might be on the verge of the apocalypse, or just happened, I'm not sure. You know, I feel that way sometimes. And I think that, you know, if you allow the nature to do what it knows to do, it has the ability to heal itself with a little bit of support and a little bit of like oomph behind it, you know, if you help to shepherd that just a tiny bit. It's really inspiring to know that we should be more in collaboration with nature than this kind of domination that we've had over the land. And I think it's really important for us to all remember that we're connected to this, that the Delta doesn't just matter for me, it matters for like planetary well-being. This is a PowerPoint where life comes to be born, where birds stop on great migrations, and, you know, where cypress forest used to be 1,000-year-old trees all around. And if we allow the nature to do what it does, it can survive this, but we're going to have to let go of believing that we can control it.
You can hear more of Sarah Holtz's interview with Monique Verdan, the artist and storyteller from South Louisiana. Visit our website, peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear the entire interview that Sarah did with Monique by clicking on Monique's photo on the episode webpage, April 2020. That's at peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear all of the programs in our series dating back to 2002. I'm Paul Ingalls, with thanks to Sarah Holtz for today's program. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
Thank you for listening to the All Souls Forum. Stay tuned for your Jazz Afternoon with KC coming up immediately, followed by the Boogie Bridge with Jason Vivoni at 3 p.m. and the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 p.m., all right here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And have a great day.